This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I get briefed together on the important questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. And if this works for you, or even if it doesn't, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. There's been much rejoicing in Greece this week after 9 years of reliance on huge bailouts from international finance bodies. The country is free once more to raise money on international markets. A day of liberation, said the Prime Minister. In the briefing room this week, we're asking, though, if Greece really is out of the woods. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room. There are plenty for you to listen to in our archive. Last week, for instance, we made a piece about Greece's old rival, Turkey. Greece, 2012.
Market turmoil as the crisis in Greece deepens. Fears grow over the future of the Eurozone.
That was then. This is now.
Today, a new day has dawned for our country, a historic day.
On Odysseus's home isle of Ithaca, the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras announced that his country's ship had finally come home.
The bailouts of austerity, recession and social desertification are finally over. Our country regains the right to shape its own future and fortunes like any normal European country, without external duress, blackmail, or sacrifices by the people.
If this is true, then it's a historic and to some people surprising moment. And it certainly is a big thing that the final bailout agreement expired on Monday and Greece is now allowed to borrow at market rates. So what I want to know today is, after all its tribulations, is Greece really out of the woods? Step into the briefing room and find out. Greece received its first bailout in 2010, but its economic difficulties began long before that. Here's Serena Tarling.
To fully understand the roots of the Greek crisis, you really need to go back to where the Euro project began for the country. It's worth remembering that when the Euro was first launched in 1999, Greece was not among the first nations to adopt the single currency. I've been talking to Michelle Kambas, who is the Athens bureau chief at Thomson Reuters.
Greece was left out of the Eurozone upon its inception in 1999 because it had failed to meet a list of criteria set by the European Union. That is placing a cap on the budget deficit at 3% of GDP and a low debt-to-GDP ratio. However, by 2000, it had produced data suggesting that these criteria were being met, and that's what allowed it to get into the Eurozone a year later.
Now it was part of the single currency club. Greece embraced the moment with gusto.
It was really heralded as a historic achievement by Athens at the time. It was a big positive shock for Greece because the cost of borrowing went down sharply. This was in fact a population which had previously been accustomed to double-digit interest rates. It led to an economic boom. There was a residential construction boom, which actually led to a rise in real estate prices.
The Greek spending spree gathered pace.
This was at a time just before the Athens Olympics as well, so there was a wave of euphoria. More people were buying homes. All of a sudden, people found it more affordable to get a mortgage. So there was a nation which was essentially in debt, but the debt was coming fairly easy to them.
But in 2004, the EU Statistics Agency took a closer look at Greece's economic figures. the Greek finance ministry were forced to admit an uncomfortable truth. They hadn't been entirely honest about its budget deficit when it joined the euro.
Essentially, what that means is that had these figures been known, Greece would not have become a member of the eurozone.
There was further turbulence ahead. 2007 saw the onset of the global financial crisis, bringing chaos and uncertainty to financial markets.
Greece's borrowing costs were progressively rising, and at some point it was simply unable to service its debt. By October of 2009, socialist PASOK won the elections. They later revealed that the country's budget deficit would exceed 12% of GDP. That was later revised upwards by several percentage points to about 15.4%.
15.4%. Remember, that's five times the eurozone's agreed limit of 3%. Bankers and foreign investors began dumping Greek assets. The spiral downward continued. By 2010, the yield on Greece's 10-year bond spiked to almost 40%. For anyone thinking of investing, Greece was simply too big a risk.
The Greek government and the Greek people were staring down an abyss. It started a chain reaction of austerity cuts, lots of uncertainty. It also triggered a lot of upheaval on the streets of Athens.
In March of 2010, the Greek government unveiled further radical measures, with more cuts in civil service pay, increases in VAT, and a freeze on pensions. By April that year, Greece had to make an impossible choice between leaving the eurozone or seeking financial support. They needed a loan, a bailout, so they went to the European Union and the International Monetary Fund to ask for help.
In return for financial support, the bailout was for 110 billion euros. The Greek government unveiled a fresh round of sweeping efficiencies, including further tax rises and deeper cuts in pensions and public sector pay. That austerity plan aimed at achieving fresh budget cuts of about 30 billion euros and aimed to further cut Greece's public deficit to less than 3% of GDP. And that plan was envisaged to be operational until 2014, at which point the objectives would have been met.
But faced with eye-watering cuts to its budget and the prospect of paying off a loan of 110 billion euros, it soon became clear that there was a lot more pain ahead.
Serena Tarling. So as you've just heard, in 2010, Greece was bailed out to the tune of 110 billion euros. The intervening years have seen immense economic and political turmoil. What have successive governments had to do to turn things around? I'm joined now in the briefing room by Roman Gerodimos. He teaches global current affairs at Bournemouth University and is the founder of the Greek Politics Specialist Group. Roman Gerodimos, we've heard that there was this first bailout in 2010 of over 100 billion euros. Now, I imagine that there were strings attached to that. What were they?
We have to remember that the first bailout agreement was put together very, very swiftly. So the approach that the lenders took, and it was the lenders that dictated the terms rather than the government, had to do with fiscal discipline. So taxation and spending cuts. Obviously, the Greek public sector had borrowed its way through the last decade. So they also demanded structural reforms, but these were, let's say, less well prescribed, to do with pensions, to do with how the government manages its resources, and so on. I have to say that the first bailout was the result of the government not being able to borrow. The interest rates were far too high. So, and it had already borrowed at high interest rates. So a lot of that money literally went into just paying off Greek bonds that were maturing at the time. So it was a very much a damage limitation exercise.
So the first bailout was a bit of an emergency,
yeah,
according to you. Now, when the conditions were set by the lenders, how specific were they?
They were pretty specific. I mean, the actual document ran in the hundreds of pages, or maybe actually thousands of pages. And it's interesting that the government was so unprepared to negotiate and deal with it that one of the top ministers said that he literally didn't have time to read the thing. He just voted for it because they had to go through it in a couple of days. You know, we're talking about a highly technical document. So it all happened very fast. I mean, we have to remember that the Papandreou government, which came at the end of 2009...
Papandreou government, which was a socialist government?
That's right, yeah. It came with a strong mandate, but they were pretty much in denial about what was happening. I mean, even though the signs were there, and they did manage eventually to keep Greece in the eurozone. But what they did do in those first months of the bailout was to sort of take too few measures too late and then not really focus on setting their own agenda, on really tackling those root causes that led Greece to the crisis.
So are you saying in the first instance that the bailout was sufficient to allow Greece to borrow a bit more and pay a bit back of what it owed, but nothing beyond that?
Well, it's not just that. It was also a very blunt instrument. So the way it approached, for example, pension reform or sort of welfare reform, it didn't show an in-depth understanding of the reality on the ground in Greece. And it didn't change the mentality around productivity, around competitiveness, around, for example, tax evasion or clientelism, all the things that actually led Greece there in the first place.
And what happened next?
So then, so I would say that the government did face an extraordinary amount of irresponsible opposition with political parties, essentially encouraging people to go out to the streets and protest and really not cooperating in the interests of the country. So, these 2 years of the first bailout program, really what you have is intensification of polarization. So that literally, it explodes in October 2011 when Papandreou comes back with a second bailout agreement, which also included a very generous haircut.
Remind us what a haircut is.
So it is when private lenders are essentially co-opted or forced to accept a haircut and basically lose, in this case, something like 75% of the overall value of their bonds.
That is some haircut.
It is. It's been called the single biggest debt restructuring deal in history. So it was a very good deal. But at that point, polarization in society had reached a point where that agreement was very unpopular and Papandreou couldn't get it through. So he called a referendum, which never happened because he didn't have time to carry it out because he was forced to resign. So eventually a new interim government puts in motion the second bailout, they implement the haircut, and then you get into a path of implementing some of those more structural reforms over the next couple of years.
So that was the moment when the populist left came to power.
Yes, that's right. That's when Syriza, the coalition of the radical left, led by a young populist leader called Alexis Tsipras, comes in and they form a government coalition with the Independent Greeks, which is a far-right xenophobic party. And they've been in coalition, surprisingly, since then.
So what then happened? There was a third bailout?
There was a third bailout, which was a huge sigh of relief, including the opposition voting, you know, the conservative opposition voting in favor of that bailout because it was seen as literally the last chance to save Greece's position in the eurozone. And it was, by and large, an unnecessary bailout because if certain things had happened, not extraordinarily difficult things, but if certain measures had been taken a few months before that, we would have avoided it.
Are you saying that what the Syriza government has done is actually carried out the measures as it criticised the previous government for carrying?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the sort of measures they've implemented, including further tax cuts and sort of literally putting a plan of budget surpluses for the next few decades, is something that previous governments wouldn't have dared to, or, you know, they wouldn't have dreamed of implementing because people would have completely gone to revolution, you know. So it's really interesting that they were able to implement really tough measures that other governments couldn't implement.
Do you think in that intervening period, we now have the announcement that Greece can go back onto the international money markets, are the structural problems that were identified in that first bailout, sure, have those now, do you think, been dealt with?
I think some of them have. There has been obviously a program of fiscal discipline that makes the Greek economy much more sustainable. However, what I would say is that the core model of what Greece produces and sort of the mentality around competitiveness, innovation, training, none of that has actually been adequately dealt with. And actually, the state of Greek hospitals and schools is much worse today than it was several years ago. So I think from that respect, the root cause of the problem has not been dealt with.
Roman Gerodimos. So lots of economic pain, lots of political intrigue. But what we haven't heard yet is the effect that this has had on the lives of ordinary Greeks. My BBC colleague, Chloe Hadjimatheou, has reported frequently from Greece over the last few years. Chloe, you've just come back from Greece. What's the mood there like now?
It's not great. I'll tell you what, when this whole thing erupted, people were furious. They were really angry. And we saw that on our TVs, people taking to the streets, riots, you know, demonstrations all the time. There still are demonstrations in Greece quite regularly, but it's not like it was. People are kind of resigned to it. That doesn't mean they like it or it's got any better. It really hasn't. It's still pretty bad, but they are resigned to it. And I was talking to a taxi driver, and you get this taxi driver wisdom in Greece. They have perfect understanding of the political situation. They sit and listen to political radio all day on in their taxis. And this man was saying to me, I don't really care whether we stay in the euro or not. You know, I don't have any money. I don't care whether my no money is in new drachmas or in euros. No money is no money. It doesn't matter what currency it's in.
Okay. What about basic services? I mean, I suppose an obvious question is, what are the hospitals like? What does it take to see a doctor? What are the schools like?
So the hospitals are in a pretty bad state. I have to say, Greek doctors are rather excellent. Education in Greece is brilliant. Most young people have a degree, and the level of care from doctors, practitioners in hospitals is brilliant. But most hospitals have had their budgets cut by about 50%. You're looking at a large percentage of a population that is uninsured. Around 2 million Greeks in a population of 11 million.
When you're uninsured in the Greek health system, does that mean you can't get healthcare?
So the Syriza government has tried to change this recently and said that hospitals should be treating the uninsured, but they haven't given them the budget to do that. So, you know, hospitals are trying to do that. But what's actually in effect happened is that solidarity clinics have popped up all around the country. So doctors who are so upset at having to turn people away because they're uninsured have opened up clinics in their spare time, in the evenings and on weekends, and are treating people.
So that's kind of like health banks, isn't it? Yeah. They're kind of equivalent of food banks.
Exactly, exactly. And the reason that people are uninsured is because if your national insurance contributions aren't up to date, you don't have access to healthcare. The only other way you can do it is by declaring poverty. But in order to declare poverty, you have to have no unpaid bills. So if you owe money to a telephone bill or to an electricity bill, you don't have access to claiming poverty. Which seems crazy, because anyone who is poor
owes stuff.
Owes stuff, yeah, exactly. I'll give you an example. One lady that I met when I was reporting in Greece had a baby. She was uninsured. She went to the hospital to give birth, and that was kind of covered by the hospital. But she had to have an emergency cesarean section, which is quite expensive. And the hospital gave her a bill at the end of her experience. And she said, well, I can't afford to pay this. And they said, well, that's okay. We'll hold on to the baby. You go off and find the money, and when you can pay, we'll give you back the baby.
No, come on.
They really did that. And it's. I'll tell you what, I thought it was an isolated case, and it does seem quite extreme. But what's really quite common is that hospitals will not give a birth certificate. So the child does not exist until you have paid for the services that the hospital gave you.
And have you tried to use medical services yourself?
I got quite ill, actually, quite soon after the Syriza election, pulled too many long night shifts working for the BBC and ended up in hospital. And I mean, I was shocked that there was absolutely no nursing care at night. There's almost nobody working in the hospital at night. So we were in a room with four women. And I had a condition that made me very dizzy. I could hardly stand up. But in the middle of the night, this old woman who was sharing a room with us in her 80s needed to use the toilet. There was no one to help her get up. I mean, she would have literally done it in the bed if me and another young girl hadn't got up and helped her to use the bathroom. It's crazy, really crazy.
And has none of that improved in the last 2 or 3 years?
I mean, it hasn't. The hospitals are still really dire. I was in a hospital about a year and a half ago, and it was still in a really bad way, peeling wallpaper, toilets with no soap or toilet paper, with leaking systems. I mean, it's horrible. The infrastructure in hospitals is absolutely terrible.
One of the things that one could imagine in this situation is that people want to get out.
They do. And there's been an enormous brain drain in Greece, absolutely huge. I'll give you an example. I live in London. My children are Greek speakers and I'm always on the lookout for Greek speaking nannies. And I put an ad in a paper for Greek expats living in London saying I would like a part time nanny. And I got a response from a qualified doctor, a qualified architect and a social worker. That was, you know, take your pick. Who do you fancy looking after your kids? I went for the doctor, actually. I just thought you might have some first aid skills. But it's amazing. All these people are leaving. And I'll tell you why. A sort of senior registrar in a Greek hospital makes about 20,000 euro a year. It's about double that in the UK. And that's if he gets a job. You know, there are just too many qualified Greeks and not enough jobs. The good news this month is that unemployment in Greece has fallen to 20% from 27%. It's still the highest in the developed world. And among youth, it's gone to 40% from 60%. This is in the under 25s. And I'll tell you what, these figures don't actually tell the real story, because loads of Greeks don't bother going and registering as unemployed, because if you haven't paid national insurance contributions, you don't have access to any unemployment benefit. What's the point?
The Prime Minister of Greece, Alexis Tsipras, has announced this week this is a kind of great moment and Greece is out of its worst troubles and so on. How do you think that will have gone down amongst the sort of people you've been talking to?
A lot of head shaking and sighing. I mean, the really sad thing is, as somebody who has watched this happen to Greece, and a lot of Greeks recognised that there was this period of overspending and too much credit going on. They realised that they'd kind of got themselves in trouble. But there was a lot of anger because they felt that the deals that were being forced upon them in the beginning were really bad for Greece, and they were. And people were furious. And now what I find really sad is that there's this resignation. The anger's gone out of them. They've accepted that there are lost generations.
But do they think it will eventually change?
I don't know. I think it's very hard for anyone in Greece right now to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
The BBC's Chloe Hadjimathou. So what now? How confident should Mr. Tsipras be that the future is, if not rosy, then at least not utterly bleak? I'm joined now in the briefing room by Kevin Featherstone. He's the director of the Hellenic Observatory at the London School of Economics. Kevin Featherstone, when you look at the situation of Greece now, what sort of economic condition do you think it's in?
Well, it certainly has been weakened, very much so, by the crisis. And I think going forward, what it can look forward to is rather a muddling through sort of trajectory of modest, limp growth on the basis of some very tight conditions and constraints imposed by the Eurozone.
You mean that actually there's not a sort of, I don't know, a tiger waiting there to escape now that the constraints are off?
Well, there might be a tiger waiting there, but it's not being allowed out of the cage, because what has happened is that Greece has had the three bailouts, but this last June, Greece was forced to agree a set of arrangements with the rest of the Eurozone, which impose very tight fiscal constraints. And I think listeners might be rather surprised to hear that the agreement is that until 2023, Greece is to run a government surplus equivalent to 3.5% of its GDP every year, and thereafter, until 2060, to run a government surplus of 2.2% of GDP.
Did you say 2060?
Until 2060, absolutely. So, beyond our lifetimes.
So which other governments in modern history have done that?
Precisely none within the Eurozone. And indeed, it's a fiscal constraint set by Germany in particular. Germany itself, of course, you remember, David, at the time of the unification of Germany with the GDR, the former East Germany, the government in Bonn, as it then was pump-priming the economy and running a deficit. So it's not a rule that the Eurozone has followed in recent times, and certainly not for this length of time, for a generation, and certainly not in the context of coming out of a deep crisis. So there might be a tiger, but the tiger is still shackled.
I suppose the question is why the bailing out countries, Germany and so on, would think that this was a useful way of projecting Greece's future for that long?
Well, I think it gets Greece out of the headlines in the sense that we have to look at the full package. The other parts of the package is that Greece actually has very low debt repayments until 2030. So that is in itself a situation which should keep Greece out of the financial headlines.
Sorry to interrupt, Kevin. Do those two things even nearly balance out? The fact that you're forgiven so much, effectively forgiven so much debt, so you don't have to pay it back, actually balances out your need to make a surplus?
Greece has gained on the swings what it's lost on the roundabouts, in the sense that it's being required to produce a government surplus so that its borrowing requirements are reduced, with the expectation that in time it will be able to repay these loans. But I think most people would be very sceptical as to whether Greece could ever repay this amount of debts, currently 180% of its GDP, in any feasible time frame.
So, in other words, it's back to the old problem, which is that the conditions attached to the repayment and the repayment itself mean that the government can't construct a level of growth which would actually make it possible within a shorter time frame to pay back the debt.
Precisely so. And domestically, it also means that the government can't pump prime the economy, can't invest in projects to get the economy moving, certainly can't invest in terms of social policy payments, etc. Coming out of the crisis, this is a government which will have its hands tied for years to come and will not be able to behave over the course of the economic cycle, boom and bust, in ways which other European governments would expect to be able to do.
So what you're saying is there is no prospect of Greek growth, of any substantial Greek growth. They just can't do it.
It will be muddling through. There's growth this year of about 2%. Thereafter, similar kinds of levels are projected. But this isn't the kind of growth trajectory that one could expect coming out of a crisis. The key point here is that the OECD in Paris does not expect Greece to return to its GDP levels of 2008 until after 2030. That's a long period of rather fragile growth.
What the ordinary person listening to this is going to say, remembering back to 2010 and then to 2015, the crisis in Greece, is, well, wouldn't it have been better then if Greece had left the euro altogether and left these constraints?
It's possible to argue that in 2010, but thereafter, I think the crisis was deepening so much that Greece was facing the choice between a rock and a hard place. Economists, I think, would agree that in the longer term, Greece being able to devalue a currency would indeed make the adjustments easier and may end up in a better place. The problem, though, is that in the short term, it would be catastrophic, and in the medium term, not at all good. That is, if you're trying to introduce a new temporary currency, there's a logistical problem of how you do that overnight, but also it's a currency that no one would wish to have. We know from the case of Argentina that when they did the equivalents, it wiped out savings, it wiped out the middle class. This is a society which has already gone through tremendous pain, but facing that kind of catastrophe would have been even worse.
Now, one of the other things that we heard a lot about in 2014, 2015 was that the euro itself was at risk and that maybe it was only a matter of time before the eurozone split up. Is the eurozone still likely to split up? Is it still likely to fail, or is it now actually recovered?
It's in a better place than it was just a few years ago. I think Anglo-Saxon economists tend to predict death of the eurozone rather too prematurely, as it were. But if we compare the eurozone's strength, the euro exchange rate is much better than that of the British pound sterling. I think the only threat on the horizon, and it's a significant risk, is what happens in the case of Italy. But otherwise, the eurozone has armed itself with what is called a European stability mechanism, which gives it lots of money to use in the eventuality of a new crisis. And it sets a lot of rules for financial discipline across governments. So for the upcoming period, it can, I think, look forward to a time of stability.
Kevin Featherstone. So what can we take away from that? Well, I don't think I'll be applying for Greek citizenship anytime soon, not until, say, 2030. My thanks to Serena Tarling, Michelle Cambas, Roman Gerodimos, Chloe Hadjimatheou, and Kevin Featherstone. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling, and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series, and you can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really do enjoy hearing from you.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.